Well, thank you very much, Andrew Goodlace. It's very good of you to invite me here tonight. It's good to be here with my colleague, Mr. McFarlane. We have a shared commitment, as all of you do, to good economic management and sound economic analysis. And you've asked me to speak tonight about the state of the nation. Well, I'm afraid to say that Ian and I don't see the state of the nation quite as rosily as some of your speakers earlier today would have done. We see great challenges posed by the mismanagement of the current government. But I want to just at the outset say something about the present state of affairs, the current government, and a little bit about our history. We've seen today a very momentous day, with Peter Costello announcing he will not seek re-election for the seat of Higgins. This is an end, or the foreshadowing of an end to 20 years in Parliament by a man who served as our Treasurer for 11 and a half years. And it's interesting to bear in mind the achievements that Peter and his colleagues, most notably, of course, his leader, John Howard, our leader, and, of course, Ian McFarlane, who was there as part of that team for much of that time in the Cabinet. It's important to remember that the strength we have today, and of which Mr. Rudd boasts so frequently, is a tribute not to any policies of Mr. Rudd's government, but a tribute to where he started. When he became Prime Minister, he inherited the best hand of economic cards that any leader could ever ask for. He did not inherit, as Barack Obama did, or as Gordon Brown did, or Tony Blair did, a government that was indebted. He inherited a government that had no debt at all, in fact, had negative net debt, had cash at the bank, about 4% of GDP's worth, cash at the bank. Had set aside funds to take future obligations off the shoulders of our children and grandchildren and those beyond. Extraordinary track record of 11 and a half years of sound economic management. And in 18 months, we've gone from that to having what will be by far the highest debt in modern Australian history. We've already had the largest deficit in our history. It was, as those of you that were watching the Treasurer on Budget Night, the deficit that dared not speak its name. Nonetheless, it was very big. So Laurie Oakes described in a column some time ago that this was due to a typographical error in the preparation of the speech. I think not. We are like, when we talk about the state of our economy and the strength of our economy, we have to bear in mind that its strength today is in very large measure a tribute to the hard work and the commitment, the focus of the previous government, and most notably, of course, the man most responsible for economic management, the Treasurer, Peter Costello. So, as I said in the House today, we salute him and we thank him for his service. It's been an extraordinary contribution to Australian public and indeed parliamentary life. Now, ever since 1960, the Committee for Economic Development of Australia has sought to raise the standard of economic analysis and debate in our nation. And I'm sure that everybody here understands the importance of rigorous analysis of government policies. This applies to all forms of government policies, be it spending on infrastructure or regulation, tax, projects of any sort. And if there's one thing that we've learnt over many years, is that we have to be critically and crucially focused on ensuring that policies have a net benefit. That's to say, they produce more good than they cost. And, of course, in business, which most of you are in, the world I left some time ago to come into politics, it's fairly straightforward, because you've got that benchmark of the bottom line. You know, ultimately, if your projects have a negative net benefit, then you'll go broke and you'll go out of business. Governments, particularly Labor governments in Australia, have been able to manage year after year of incompetence with more and more spin. But there have been some lonely voices out there in the wilderness, perhaps, like CEDA, like the Productivity Commission, from time to time, the Treasury, who have talked about the importance of rigorous analysis. And Australia has certainly benefited from that. There are very few advanced economies that have performed as well over recent decades as we have, when our economy achieved strong growth, low inflation, generational lows in unemployment and rising wages. And so since that recipe had worked so well, it was no wonder that the Prime Minister, this man who now describes himself as a democratic socialist, who says, and I quote, that he wants to put government at the centre of the economy. Think of that. Think of that. That's what he says. This is not what liberals say about him. This is what he says about himself. Anyway, there it is. That's what he wants to do. But in the lead up to the election, he described himself as an economic conservative, tried to present himself as just a younger version of John Howard in economic terms. And indeed, in 2007, Mr. Rudd explicitly promised an evidence-based and rigorous analysis of Commonwealth policies, particularly those involving costly projects such as investments in infrastructure. And we now know, sadly, that this commitment to rigorous and responsible analysis has turned out to be just as bogus as his claims were to be an economic conservative. Only last May, 2008, the government said in the budget papers, and I quote, "Efficient public infrastructure investment requires decision-making based on thorough and rigorous cost-benefit analysis, a commitment to transparency at all stages, a public sector financial management regime with clear accountabilities and responsibilities." That's from budget paper number one, if you want to have a sort of nostalgic look at what they claimed they were going to do as opposed to what's happened. And yet since then, the government's made a succession of decisions about infrastructure investments worth an amount fast approaching $100 billion over the next decade, without any analysis to speak of, let alone the thorough and rigorous cost-benefit analysis which is clearly required for good decision-making. The opportunity which the government has seized with both hands to justify its lack of serious analysis is the global financial crisis. The GFC supposedly justified rash decisions on a weekend last October to introduce an unlimited bank guarantee and to give away $10 billion in public money. That guarantee, as we know, set in train a series of unintended but unfortunate consequences in those parts of the financial markets not benefiting from the guarantee. The first $10 billion cash giveaway, just like the larger $12 billion follow-up announced in February this year, had a relatively modest impact on economic activity compared to its costs. Naturally, because, as any student of the economic experience of these one-off cash handouts could have told the government, because most of the money was saved and not spent. Both policies should have been the subject of accurate, balanced and comprehensive analysis to make sure the benefits exceeded the costs and that the risks were well understood. It didn't happen in either case. And now we see the same lack of care, lack of analysis, with respect to the investments in infrastructure. It's bad enough to plunge into public debt at a pace not seen since the 1940s in the name of combating an unprecedented economic threat that, in fact, has so far, thank heavens, inflicted less damage on the Australian economy than either the 1982 or 1991 downturns. But even worse is to squander the bulk of that borrowed money on programs and projects that appear unlikely to generate real longer-term economic benefits. Not only will we end up deep in hock, that, my friends, is for sure, but we will have relatively little to show for it. What will we have to show for it? Now, tonight I want to discuss five examples where the Rudd government is committed to major spending or changes without properly analysing the resulting costs and benefits to our economy. Well, let's start with economic infrastructure. if you believe the rhetoric from Mr Rudd and Mr Swan, investment in infrastructure is at the heart of the government's fiscal stimulus and accounts for the lion's share of the $124 billion of discretionary new spending over the forward estimates that Labor has unveiled since 2007. But when you strip away the sloganeering about nation building, it quickly becomes apparent that only a small part of what Labor is selling as infrastructure in fact equates to the traditional way that term is used in fiscal policy to describe spending on assets that directly add to the productive capacity of the economy. There is no doubt spending $15 billion on primary school assembly halls and libraries, $4 billion on roof insulation and solar panels, and $6 billion on social housing, a euphemism for the Commonwealth stepping in where the states have dropped the ball, will create some jobs. It could hardly do otherwise. Of course it will. But how much will it add to the nation's longer-term economic potential? And even if it does, where is the proof? The list of actual economic infrastructure projects, ports, roads, railways and the like, proposed by the government in the 2009 budget is very opaque. Despite the creation of Infrastructure Australia, a body announced with great fanfare and allegedly charged with conducting exactly the sort of rigorous, transparent cost-benefit analysis I've been discussing, there is literally no information available on why certain projects were chosen and others rejected. Any cost-benefit analysis undertaken by Infrastructure Australia will remain confidential, even for projects where there is no private money involved. As a result, we do not know why the government only partially funded some projects, the Gold Coast Light Rail, for example, but fully and generously funded others, the West Melbourne Rail Link, for example, that goes through the electorate of half a dozen federal Labor ministers and MPs. We also don't know why the Rudd government chose to almost entirely ignore projects in Sydney, the Australian city where the economic costs of increasing congestion are higher than any other, although we could hazard a guess that the frosty relationship between the Prime Minister and the New South Wales Premier probably played a part. Labor has quickly stripped most of the cash out of the three infrastructure funds it had set up using the Coalition's last budget surplus, the $20 billion delivered for the 2007-2008 financial year. Those funds will not be available to spend again. Despite the Rudd government's rhetoric, however, Australians will remain in the dark over whether the projects that were funded were more likely to add the most to national wealth over the years ahead. Turning now to the national broadband network. Now, when Labor's tender for a national broadband network collapsed, the Prime Minister announced that the government would deliver to 90% of households and businesses a 100 megabits per second fibre to the home broadband network for a cost, it was said, of $43 billion. It would, he said, be commercially viable. The private sector would be knocking down the doors to buy 49% of it, and it was so good a deal that the Prime Minister urged mums and dads to invest in it too. He did that on television. Without wanting to give legal advice, those of you in business, I discourage you from doing anything like this. You will not be treated as gently by ASIC as the Prime Minister was. The government made all these claims about a $43 billion investment, bigger than the Snowy Mountains scheme, they crowed, without any cost-benefit analysis or a business plan, without even a statement of the most basic assumptions behind the proposal. Kerry O'Brien's interview with the Prime Minister could best be described as a brisk foot rub. It was so unchallenging. But the next morning, Fran Kelly, determined to restore the reputation of the ABC, dared to ask the Treasurer a couple of questions. She said, "You've said this will be commercially viable. How many people will actually take it up? How many subscribers will you have?" The Treasurer said he didn't know. Fair enough, that's only one assumption, I guess. What will you charge, she asked. He didn't know that either. But nonetheless, without any basis whatsoever, our government, our Prime Minister, our Treasurer, our ministers went out and said to the Australian public they were going to spend $43 billion on a national broadband network. It would be commercially viable, and they had no reasonable basis whatsoever for saying so. And the fact The real question to me is not simply that they were so reckless in saying that, but that there has not been more public outrage than they were. Because I can tell you the consequences for anyone in the business world, and all of you know this, for acting in that way would be so severe it's not worth contemplating. This was just recklessness of the highest order. Now, it's often said that vision without resources is a hallucination. Well, a $43 billion vision without any business plan, without any way of knowing of how or whether it can be paid for, is a very, very dangerous hallucination indeed. The complete absence of any business plan or financial projections for that $43 billion broadband network explains why the Finance Minister, Lindsay Tanner, admitted the government had no idea how much the network would cost or whether it was commercially feasible. Every now and then, Lindsay just can't help himself and he actually breaks out of the spin and utters a few facts. But it's an extraordinary thing. If you look at the budget papers, there is a glossy volume, a thin volume there, about infrastructure. By far the largest section, 6 pages, and by far the largest amount, $43 billion, is devoted to this national broadband network. The government does not have one spreadsheet, one line of analysis, and yet they went out there and they promised that. And they were praised by columnists and editorial writers and self-interested rent seekers in the telecommunications industry that thought they could freeload off it. They were just praised to the heights. And it's your money. It's your money. It's our money. It's our taxes that are likely to be spent on this. I think we did some analysis of it and demonstrated, pretty straightforward really, that assuming they could get half the target audience to pay $100 a month, which is obviously huge, gigantic penetration and much higher than anybody pays for broadband now, they would still lose $260 million a year before interest. I mean, this national broadband network has been a complete scandal. And I'd say to you, those of you concerned about public administration and prudent economic management need to stand up and support us holding the government to account, because they'll end up spending that money and they will build something for $43 billion and it'll end up being worth about 10. And the difference will be paid for by the taxpayer. Now, primary school assembly halls. Grave concerns are surfacing about the delivery of the $15 billion Building the Education Revolution program. Among the many problems of the program, schools are having facilities foisted on them that in no way meet their particular needs. Some schools which need new classrooms are being told they must have new school halls, the Julia Gillard Memorial Hall, which they don't need because they already have one. The reason for the emerging problems in this program is the lack of analysis before the program began. There was no analysis about it at all. It was just decided that every primary school was going to get a library or a school hall. And the lack of analysis there has resulted in extraordinary anomalies. Schools which didn't want these facilities or didn't need them getting them anyway, and, of course, getting them at a much higher cost. Dealing with schools, you've also got the digital education revolution. Labor launched what it called the digital education revolution during the 2007 election campaign, promising to spend up to $1 billion to provide, and I quote, a computer on the desk of every upper secondary student. All year 9 to 12 students would have their own computer, which could include personal laptops or thin clients. That wasn't part of the obesity program, that's something else. But what went wrong with this policy? As we know, just about everything went wrong with it. And the reason for this was the lack of any credible analysis underpinning the proposal. The fund was clearly inadequate to achieve its stated objective. There are nearly 1 million full-time students in years 9 to 12, so the amount provided was about $1,000 a head. This was barely adequate for purchasing a laptop or other device for each student. But the cost of putting a computer on every desk doesn't stop there. Among the costs not considered by the government were the physical fit-out of the classrooms, including remodelling, new PowerPoints, wiring, air conditioning, desks, chairs, servers and other equipment, including printers, software and subscriptions, technical support, maintenance, replacement, insurance and consumables, training and major upgrades. Apart from that, they sort of got it all nailed down. Estimates from IT professionals suggested a cost of $3,000 to $10,000 over the life of each machine. I mean, Andrew's in the IT business, Sun Microsystems, I know many of you are. As we all know, the money is made in the maintenance and the servicing, not in selling the hardware. So what does it say about a government that promises a digital revolution and doesn't take into account the major costs? Labor didn't have a clue about the cost of this policy, plainly. That's not even controversial. But its presentation of the benefits was cursory and misleading. The detailed OECD report, which Labor referred to in its policy statement, says there is no simple relationship demonstrating that the more students use computers, the better they'll perform. Further, and I'm quoting now from this PISA report, in countries where basic computer access is approaching universal access, policy needs to turn its attention from providing the technology to ensuring its usage is effective. This means ensuring that teachers are appropriately trained and that ICT usage is well integrated in the timetable and curriculum. Now, that, of course, conclusion is particularly relevant to Australia, where access is near universal and the number of school computers is already high. So it's worth contrasting Labor's approach to education funding, both the computers and the school halls, to our program when we were in government, a program called Investing in Our Schools, which made $1.18 billion. That seems like an inconsequential amount of money in the RUD speak, doesn't it? Where you spend $43 billion on a broadband network without a business plan. But anyway, when we were in government, we thought $1.18 billion of your taxes was a lot of money, and we cared about it. We made that available over 2005-2008 to all schools and for a range of purposes. Rather than a directive from the ALP for a digital education revolution or the nightmare of building a series of Julia Gillard Memorial Halls, investing in our schools assisted schools to meet their most pressing needs by asking each school to tell the government what they wanted. You can see that we are the party of business. You can see we've got that worked out. The customer's always right. And under this program, some schools received funding for computers, others received money for ICT-related purposes, such as upgrading the power supply or installing air conditioning. Some schools received funding for musical instruments, science laboratory equipment, outdoor equipment, whole range of things. What we said to schools was, you tell us what you want. You work out what you want, and then you deliver it. You deliver it. And that not only did it mean that schools got what they needed, but it also meant that they got what they needed at the right cost. Now, we had an example that we referred to in question time today, where as part of this building the education revolution, there is a sort of shaded play area as being established in one school in New South Wales for a cost of $400,000. 6 years ago, same installation in the same school was built for $40,000. Right around the country, local tradesmen and builders and construction companies are being left out because the only people getting the work via this huge $14 billion program are big firms that are contracting via state governments. And so not only are a lot of schools getting facilities they don't actually need, but they're getting it at a much greater cost. And, of course, it's your money. Now, finally, I want to touch on the emissions trading scheme, or the so-called carbon pollution reduction scheme. Now, there has been there an appalling lack of transparency and disclosure over its economic impact. I know you've talked a lot about it today. There is fairly widespread acceptance that an ETS, as opposed to a carbon tax, is likely to be the most efficient way to put a price on carbon in most economies. nonetheless, the details of its design and implementation are of great concern. In particular, like most economic reforms, the costs and benefits that arise during the transition period after its introduction, but prior to the economy undergoing long-term structural adjustment to the change, are very important to understand. Incredibly, despite the fact that the proposed ETS is arguably the most important single policy-driven change to our economy ever, there has supposedly been no official modelling of its transitional impact on regions, industry, or sectors or firms whatsoever. Nor has there been any public analysis of the costs and benefits of this particular ETS as an abatement measure compared to other ETS designs or non-ETS policies, such as a carbon tax. It's patently obvious that the transitional cost of the ETS will be heavily felt in certain industries and regions, and the work that Frontier Economics did for the Government of New South Wales, which has never been officially published, but has found its way into the public domain, is eloquent but disturbing testimony to that. This is particularly so given the anomalous treatment of the coal industry in the current design. It's dishonest of the government to have glossed over this reality and to have failed to level with the people of the Hunter and Latrobe Valleys, Illawarra, the Pilbara, Central Queensland and other heavily impacted regions where there is strong dependence on emissions-intensive industries. Hiding the transitional effects of a deliberate policy choice is hardly the way to build public confidence in the way public policy is made. Now, if governments proceed with ill-considered projects, the consequences are obvious. Resources will be shifted from higher value public and private uses to lower value public uses. This is at the heart of our concern about rising government debt. As debt rises inexorably to pay for this government's poor spending decisions, Australia's future economic development is harmed. We must not be misled by Labor's rhetoric that the increase in debt is manageable because it is from a low base. This Labor government will run up more than twice as much debt in less than half the time as Paul Keating did. It took the Coalition, together with the Australian people, 10 years to pay off $96 billion of Keating Labor debt and leave a legacy of no net debt, in fact, negative net debt, to this government. How many years will it take us to pay off hundreds of billions of dollars of Mr Rudd's debt? The increase in public debt is only in part the natural result of a slower economy, reducing government revenue and increasing government expenditures, the automatic stabilisers, as so described. Since November 2007, the Rudd government has taken decisions to increase spending by $124 billion, two-thirds of the $188 billion in debt we will accumulate, and that's net debt, by 2012-2013, according to the budget papers. And that number is surely an underestimate, as it doesn't count, for example, the likely public cost of Labor's national broadband dreams, at least $43 billion, and who knows, maybe much more. The Coalition has consistently questioned the quality and the purpose of much of this spending. The idea that a government faced with a worsening outlook would borrow $23 billion and give it away defies common sense. They didn't spend it on roads or railways or bridges or ports, they gave it away. Most of it naturally, as I said earlier, was saved and not spent, and so its impact on the economy was minimal and short-lived. In fact, the budget papers reveal that Treasury estimates only 30,000 jobs will have been supported as of mid-2009 by all of Labor's stimulus measures so far, including the entire $23 billion in cash splashes. That's $766,000 per job. And even when the government is not just giving money away, when it's saying it's investing in infrastructure for the future, the choices it makes are all too often very poor. Now, it's because of this constant lack of serious policy analysis by the government that the Coalition proposed in the budget and reply speech creating an Australian version of the US Congressional Budget Office. The CBO has long provided the Congress with objective and impartial advice and analysis on fiscal policy and the effects of new policies proposed by either side of US politics. We will establish a parliamentary budget office chartered to provide Parliament with independent and objective analysis of fiscal policy, including long-term projections of the impact of measures on the economy, employment, real interest rates and debt levels. It would be able to examine major proposals such as the National Broadband Network or the Digital Education Revolution or the Building the Education Revolution. It would therefore put pressure on government to undertake its own serious analysis of policies. It would be responsible to the Parliament rather than to the Executive, much like the Auditor-General or the Commonwealth Ombudsman, staffed with economic, accounting and actuarial experts and overseen with an independent tenure. Now, governments never welcome greater scrutiny, and so I'm under no illusion that this proposal will be greeted with any enthusiasm by the Prime Minister and the Treasurer. Indeed, when we establish it, I'm sure Ian Macfarlane and I will regret it from time to time. But nonetheless, it'll do us good, and it'll do Australia good, because such a body would contribute greatly to a better informed debate about Australia's public finances and the consequence of different choices. It's vital, coming back to where I began, that we maintain and support a rigorous economic analysis of government spending and investment decisions. That has been lacking. It's been cast aside in the panic response to the global financial crisis, but it's time for that to stop. There is no substitute for rigorous analysis. The dollars the government is spending are our taxes, and the debt they are incurring will be paid by us, our children and grandchildren, for many decades to come. Thank you very much.
I was going to say, I'm Michael Porter. I'm from the Grateful Dead. I really enjoyed the spray of funds from Mr. Rudd. Well, actually, I'm Michael Porter. I'm Research Director at CEDA, and we did take on the broadband issue. And indeed, last year in December, and again for this inquiry, produced an analysis remarkably consistent with your own. But we went further. We said, hey, there's four doors swinging here. There's broadband through copper, VDSL, ADSL on the copper. There's cable, which unfortunately the coalition government stopped from being competitive under Minister Alston, but could deliver 300 times the speed of most people in the room. There's wireless that's incredibly fast in what's emerging from new technology, and that could generate $15 billion of funds by auctioning the frequency range made released by the closure of analog television. And then, of course, there's fibre. Now, we think force-feeding fibre down the streets of Carlton or wherever is something for Kellogg's. It's not for Telstra or anybody else. So my question is, will the coalition this time come out for competition in telecommunications? Because you're right that they're proposing $43 billion of spending. CEDA said don't spend it, raise $15 billion through auctioning of frequencies. So will the coalition in government reverse this, convert broadband into a source of revenue rather than deficits? Thank you.
Well, thank you. I'm just trying to get the Kellogg's fibre metaphor straight. Now, look, let me make a couple of comments here. The reality is that there are parts of Australia we can describe as regional and rural Australia, the definition of which can be debatable, but just use that as a term, where there is going to be a requirement for some government support to deliver affordable broadband. And that was what we had with our OPEL scheme, which was designed to do that for a modest cost. It was less than $1 billion of government subsidy. When I say it's modest, it seems like a hell of a lot of money to me, but everything's modest compared to the way Rudd's spending. And as for the rest, we saw that as really being resolved by competition in the market. You're absolutely right about the dangers of getting transfixed by one form of technology over another. I've been involved in the telecommunications industry in different ways for a long time, and most of the technologies that are mundane and commonplace today, I would not have confidently forecast a decade ago by any means. You know, maybe not, some of them not even 5 years ago. So the change is very rapid. But the one thing that is clear is that most people who do have access to high-speed broadband today choose not to pay for it, actually pay less money for a slower speed. So there's a big question as to whether there is really a market at a realistic price, an economic price, for 100 megabits a second. So that's a... I think that the question is that there actually isn't. There isn't a market at an economic price. The other thing is that part of the functionality, of course, is mobility. And as wireless broadband becomes more and more capable and you get up to 20, 30, 40 megabits a second available in wireless broadband, then for, you know, modern Australia, an Australia where increasingly people don't bother having fixed lines and just have, you know, mobile phones, why would you pay a lot of money to have high-speed cable broadband when you've got high-speed mobile wireless broadband, which then enables you to take it anywhere, you know, to work, to a restaurant, to the beach, or, you know, wherever you want to go. You can take it wherever you go. So that functionality is very compelling. And I mean, over the years, I've seen so much money lost by really smart people in business picking technologies. When you start contemplating governments doing that, it really is a recipe for disaster. I mean, just think of the extraordinary, you know, it must have been close to hundreds of billions of dollars lost by that overbuild of subsea cable by people like Level 3 and Global Crossing and PSINet in the late 90s, you know, at the end of the tech boom. Now, these are all really smart people, and they just got the market, they got the timing completely wrong and blasted away billions of dollars. So, you know, when you see someone like Kevin Rudd with no business plan, no analysis, but with a huge checkbook, your checkbook, talking about this kind of thing, you know it's a recipe for gigantic losses and huge accretions to our national debt.
David Kobloff from Monash University. When John Howard in 2006, at the 50th anniversary of Quadrant, said that we shouldn't underestimate the extent to which the soft left holds sway, even dominance, in universities, we thought that might be a clue to the reason why, during the Howard government, the pause button was essentially pushed on increases in government spending on universities, so much so that we fell behind in comparison to other OECD countries as a percentage of public investment in universities. What's your coalition's view about the future of universities? What's your vision for the future of the higher education sector?
Well, look, I've been to quite a few universities, and I'm very committed to universities and investing in them. And we put a lot of money away into a higher education fund, I might say, when we were in government to support them. But ultimately, the support, essentially, I think the university sector has got to, as with all education sectors, have got to be prepared to compete. They've got to be prepared to be judged on their comparative merits. From my point of view, the more freedom that is given to the consumers, that is to say the students, the better. I've had some interesting experiences with universities over the years, both as a student and also, interestingly, for a period I was very involved in keeping alive Bond University, you know, which is a most improbable creation, as you know, by Alan Bond and Haranori Takahashi, you know, and yet it's proved to be a very durable institution. And it's very, very interesting to look at Bond University. It's not a big university, but it survived as a private university without a government subsidy, which
competes because it provides differentiated products. You know, you can do, you know, they spend a lot more money on their academic faculty relative to their administration than the public universities do, and they provide courses that are more flexible and faster and without compromising academic outcomes. And I think that the reality is that the higher education sector, as with all education, will over time, it'll be hard because of course the culture that's embedded there will have to become more and more competitive, particularly as students look to other institutions, including institutions overseas.
Mr. Turnbull, thank you for your very informative and entertaining speech tonight. Coming from Queensland, I was just wondering what your thoughts are of a single Conservative Party for Australia.
Well, it's a great, you know, it's a good idea in an ideal sense, but I don't think there's any prospect of it happening anytime soon. The LNP in Queensland, which I think has been a great success, was driven really from out of special Queensland circumstances and particularly focused at the need to have a united front in state elections. But there isn't a... there was a need to merge in Queensland, I think a political need to merge, but there isn't really an urge to merge anywhere else in Australia. You know, I might say the coalition between the Liberals and the Nationals, while there are sometimes differences of opinion, they are relatively rare, and it's been a very successful political partnership over a long period of time.
Rachel Merton, KPMG. Mr. Turnbull, if I could just pick up an issue that you've raised a couple of times, and I think in your reply to the budget you touched on it, and that's recognising some of the difficulties that business have in doing, in contracting to government. In recognition of that, and some of these concerns are shared with, you know, many of my colleagues here tonight, if you might be able to touch on what the coalition would sort of envisage to do to simplify the government procurement contracting arrangement.
Thanks, Rachel. We're committed to reducing the regulatory and red tape burden on business to the lowest in the OECD. We will be absolutely ruthless about that. We have to move as much as we can of compliance, licensing, tendering, you name it, online. It is ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous, that people are still filling in forms in paper, submitting tenders in, you know, reams of paper. Government has not moved adequately into the electronic age by any means. It is crazy that we make it so hard with so much regulation, which gets added to every year, for people to start businesses. You know, we've been having these Jobs for Australia forums around the country, which are essentially, you know, meetings of typically, you know, say around 50 people. They're probably the average size, mostly small business, and we talk about the issues that are confronting small businesses, how we've developed a lot of our policies, such as the tax loss carryback policy, which is a good one that, in a way, I was hoping the government would take up. In a way, I was hoping they wouldn't too, of course. But in these meetings, you know, you get harrowing stories. There was one lady that I've mentioned publicly a few times that really stuck in my mind. She and her husband had started a bed and breakfast in Coffs Harbour, and they had one employee, a part-time housekeeper, and she went through all of the red tape she had to go through to set up that business. And I was just thinking, you know, this is crazy. We can do so much better than that. So we are very, very committed to being absolutely ruthless in reducing the amount of red tape. It's really important too for small business, Rachel, because I've got a view, many of you have heard me say this before, so I apologise for repeating it, but I have a view that this town, Canberra, is very well attuned to big business. If you are a bureaucrat in the Australian public service, you understand the culture of big companies, you know, of a bank or a big resources company or a big retailer. You don't have a real understanding of the business
whose owner is also the chief financial officer, the chief HR officer, the information officer, you know, and probably, you know, and opens and locks the place up every day. And I think small businesses as tends to get overlooked by governments. Now, I'm determined to change that, and one of the ways to change that is to lower the level the playing field, lower the bar for small businesses to compete, and tendering and compliance plays a big part in that.
Thanks, Mr. Turnbull. Megan Motto from the Association of Consulting Engineers. And I actually have a follow-on question. One of the biggest issues that business has in working or tendering to government is the issue of risk management and risk shifting that inevitably happens, mainly because of the conservatism of Western governments across the world, but in particular the conservatism of the bureaucracy and the individual agencies. If the coalition was returned to power, what would you do in order to level the playing field, as you said, in terms of risk allocation in private sector contracting with government in particular?
This is... you're talking about the tendency of governments to want to have very large corporate counterparties as opposed to smaller firms?
Not so much. I'm talking about whether they're contracting on a very large and complex project or a very small project which is fairly basic in its risk profile, they're still requiring onerous levels of liability and insurance and contract conditions and so on and so forth.
Well, I think you've got... I think it's important to be commercial about that. I think one of the challenges that governments face is that the price of asking parties with whom they're contracting, you know, your members, for example, to take on absolutely all of the risk and, in effect, indemnify and hold harmless the government entirely, the amount of benefit or the amount of protection the government is buying as a result of that is probably far outweighed by the additional cost on the contract. So, and you also run the risk that a lot of that, have the concern that some of that risk can't actually be adequately insured. So, you know, there's no substitute for being hard-headed and commercial. It's hard to, you know, it's hard to state a policy on that other than that governments have got to be realistic about these things. And there is I understand the phenomenon you're talking about, but it's essentially a commercial issue.
Mr. Turnbull, my name's Brendan Tatham.
Hi, Brendan.
There are so many issues, but the one I'll choose to talk with you about is, as I speak to you as president of our local school council, so I refer to the education revolution. Our local school has received an amount of Commonwealth funds, which is really nice, to build some infrastructure, and that's been, as you mentioned, given to the states to distribute. And in our particular state, what's been given has been the Commonwealth funds, but without the state matching funds. And so what I am interested to hear from you about is really your vision for how states can be held accountable for how they do business with the Commonwealth in delivering services.
There's been a call from the front row to abolish them, but I have a distinguished track record in not changing the Australian Constitution, so I won't put that up as a possibility. Look, I think the federal government's just got to, live up to its rhetoric. I mean, when they announced this school program, Julia Gillard said she would, not tolerate any cost shifting by the states, in effect backing their funding out to let the Commonwealth funding swarm in. And in the South Australian state budget, the capital works part of the education budget was cut by 12%, I think for 2009-2010. So what's the Commonwealth done about it? Nothing. So, you know, they should just say, it's very simple, they can just say, you either stick to your committed level of funding or you will not get the Commonwealth money. Now, they're perfectly able to do that, but they haven't done it. And so as a result, Maybe sounds like your school is not, in net terms, much better off at all.
Good evening, Malcolm. Tim Shanahan from the University of Western Australia. I'd just like to ask you to perhaps comment on the BHP Billiton Rio Tinto transaction which is proposed, and firstly, and then secondly, any comments that you might have on the impact of that transaction in relation to our relationships with China?
Well, look, as far as the transaction's concerned, at a political level, I prefer it to the Chinalco Rio deal. I gave a speech to the Lowy Institute about 6 weeks ago in which I explained why I didn't think the Chinalco Rio deal was in Australia's national interest, at least on the terms it was proposed. As far as attitudes to from China are concerned, I'll just tell you what I said to the Chinese Minister for Propaganda about this. I met him a couple of months ago. It's interesting. He gave me a very good rundown on how well their economy was going. And, of course, you had to think all the time. He is the Minister for Propaganda. But anyway. But he was a very smart guy, and we talked about this issue. And I'll just tell you exactly what I said to him. I said that in 1949, when Chairman Mao finally took over China, he stood on the top of Tiananmen and addressed the Chinese nation. And he concluded his speech by saying, "Zhongguo Renmin Dan Qi Lai Le," which means, as the Prime Minister would know, the Chinese people have stood up, right? The Chinese people have stood up. And part of their mission was to get control of their own country again, to have control of their own resources. That was a fundamental part of their national revolution. And so China, of all countries, should well understand that a nation like Australia has legitimate concerns about maintaining an appropriate degree of sovereignty over its own natural resources. And so the issues with Chinalco Rio are very profound ones. I mean, Chinalco is not just a Chinese company. It is a wing of the Chinese government. Its executives are appointed by the Communist Party. And it is... I'm not trying to sort of raise a red rag here, but it is these Chinese state-owned organisations are the Chinese government. You know, they are not public listed companies on the Shanghai Stock Exchange, you know, with a broad institutional shareholding and a bunch of retail shareholders like we have in Australia. So there are legitimate issues of sovereignty. So I conclude my explanation of this to my Chinese friends by saying, in conclusion, "Ao Dalia Renmin Zan Qi Lai Le," the Australian people have stood up.
We probably have time for just one more question. So, yep.
Oh, how wonderful. Mike Zorbas, opposition leader, Stockland.
Are you related to Helen Zorbas?
Only distantly.
Oh,
distantly,
right. She's a great lady.
She is a great lady.
The Zorbasses are obviously a great family.
It's a deep and proud gene pool, you're right. opposition leader, I suppose this is more in keeping with the brisk foot rub end of the questions, but Annabelle Crabb recently did her homework on you with her very long quarterly essay. I think it was 35,000 words. If you were to give that a report card, how would you grade it? What comments would you give her back? And secondly, I suppose, other than Annabelle and Fran Kelly, who you've named luminously this evening, who would be your favourite living Australian journalist?
Well, that's a good question. Look, as far as Annabelle's piece is concerned, I'm sure I deserved all the criticism and didn't deserve any of the praise. She's a very entertaining writer, and but it's all, that's her own work, and people find it engaging. That's that is good. As far as good Australian journalists, well, look, I'll treat that quite seriously. I would say, in terms of political journalists, the the political journalist I learnt the most from in my youth, who's no longer living, was Alan Reid, you know, who is an old, legendary old press gallery journalist here for, you know, going back to the 1940s. But I think today the political writer that I think is most thoughtful and wise and influential is probably Paul Kelly. And, you know, Paul manages to combine incisive daily journalism, which is a slog, with writing some of, you know, these great magisterial works on Australian politics and history, like, you know, that big work of his, The End of Certainty, which I'm sure many of you have read, and he's bringing out the successor volume to that. So if he says cruel things about me in that, I will, of course, review this opinion and revise it. But no, but I think that's... But there, you know, there's a lot of good journalists. When I was I was a journalist. I started off as a journalist. In fact, my life has been one of constant decline. I started off lumping bananas in the Sydney fruit and vegetable markets, and then I fell into journalism, then law, then business, and now politics. I don't know what's left in my Hogarthian rake's progress decline. But the but I remember I was taken up by a guy called Harold Evans in England, who I met at a Cambridge Union debate many, many years ago, and I subsequently worked for him. He was a legendary journalist. He was the great campaigning editor of the Sunday Times, and you know, really created investigative journalism, and, you know, was just a total guru. And Harry was trying to persuade me to drop out of law school and start working for him straight away. And he said, "You don't want to be a lawyer." He said, "You don't want to be a lawyer." He said, "It's so dull." He said, "Think of it." He said, "You could end up being a judge. That'd be ghastly. Or worse still, you could end up in Parliament. It's unthinkable." You know? So, anyway, fortunately, I resisted that, and here I am in Parliament.